Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Norman Solomon, co-founder of the activist group RootsAction.org, who talks about the Democratic Party's weak response to Donald Trump's unconstitutional demolition of the federal government and threat to democracy. New Haven, Connecticut Mayor Justin Elliker, who explains why he's joined other U.S. cities and counties to sue the Trump regime for their threat to withhold federal funding from sanctuary cities. And Katherine Jacobson of the Committee to Protect Journalists, who takes a critical look at Donald Trump's alarming campaign of threats and intimidation to suppress U.S. press freedom. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Donald Trump's freeze on humanitarian aid, mass staff layoffs, and deep budget cuts at the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, have led to the deaths of refugees on the Thai-Myanmar border, home to 90,000 people displaced by years of repression, war, and Myanmar's 2021 military coup. As aid groups, including the International Rescue Committee, were forced to shut down their health clinics, Thai hospitals have tried to fill the gap. The Guardian reports a 30-year-old refugee with a young daughter died 2 weeks after she was taken off dialysis treatment due to the Trump aid freeze. In early February, another Myanmar refugee, a 71-year-old woman, died in a refugee camp 4 days after she was forcibly discharged from a health clinic without access to a supplemental oxygen tank. Despite a pledge from newly appointed U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio that life-saving assistance would be exempt from the 90-day aid freeze, Trump's decision has been deadly. On February 26, 20 activists were arrested at the Cannon House office building in Washington, D.C., in an attempt to focus public attention on the Trump regime's potentially catastrophic termination of USAID's highly effective and life-saving PEPFAR program. Launched by former President George W. Bush, PEPFAR provided HIV/AIDS medication to 20 million people worldwide. Over the past month, the Trump administration's contentious reset of U.S. foreign policy on the Ukraine war and the imposition of new U.S. tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China have been the focus of extensive media coverage. But far below the radar is a possible change in U.S. policy toward the Western Balkans, where Serb nationalism erupted into devastating wars in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Kosovo in the 1990s. For nearly three decades, renewed conflict in the Balkans has been averted after the 1995 Dayton Peace Agreement was signed. But there's growing concern that Trump could flip sides and back Serbian nationalists and Russia, upsetting a fragile equilibrium in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Kosovo. Since Trump left the White House in 2021, his top aides have cultivated ties among Serb leaders. Serb nationalists in Republika Srpska, the separatist government in Bosnia and Herzegovina, are optimistic that Trump could break with most EU and NATO members and instead align with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has close relationships with both Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Following the Right Wing Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 blueprint, the Trump administration is dismantling key election security programs, which have helped state and municipal governments combat foreign interference in U.S. elections. Over the last 7 years, the FBI and the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency assisted election officials to better protect election facilities and prevent cyber attacks by foreign interests. On February 5th, Trump's newly appointed U.S. Attorney General, Pam Bondi, issued a memo announcing it was terminating the FBI Foreign Intelligence Task Force, cutting 100 positions at the U.S. Cybersecurity Agency launched in 2017 by Trump-appointed FBI Director Christopher Wray. Bondi said the move was undertaken to stop the weaponization and abuse of prosecutorial discretion, parroting Project 2025's unsupported assertion that the left had used the task force to censor speech and affect the outcome of elections. In Michigan, Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram, who received election security assistance from the task force last year, said, "It seems as though the Trump administration is doing everything it can to encourage foreign interference in our elections." She stressed, "We must remain vigilant." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump was sworn in as president for his second term on January 20th, the twice-impeached convicted felon, along with billionaire Elon Musk, have unconstitutionally attempted to eliminate entire federal agencies, fire hundreds of thousands of government workers, frozen funding for life-saving programs here in the U.S. and abroad, and launched a witch hunt to fire and defund any individual or institution that worked to combat racial, gender, and other discrimination, or promoted diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. After pardoning all 1,500 of his insurrectionist supporters that were convicted of crimes, including vicious attacks on police officers on January 6, 2021, Trump and the Republican Party are now attempting to cut $880 billion, mostly from Medicaid, that provides health care to more than 90 million Americans in order to pay for $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, primarily benefiting the rich and profitable corporations. In a recent commentary titled "Democrats Irritated by Voters Who Elected Them Need an Attitude Adjustment," Norman Solomon, co-founder of the activist group RootsAction.org, maintains that too many Democratic Party elected officials haven't adequately responded to the serious threat to democracy posed by the Trump-Musk administrative coup. Here, Solomon advocates that Democrats who failed to put up a fight against Trump and the GOP, normalizing the president's authoritarian power grab, should face primary challenges from grassroots progressive candidates.
The vast majority of the Democrats in the House and Senate, they have proceeded as though this is more or less normal, one party butting heads against the other. There are exceptions of members of the House and Senate who are speaking out, who are making very clear that it's not just a battle of rhetoric, it's a battle of whether democracy is going to be crushed by the Trumpists, by the current fascistic Republican Party. One of the reasons I wrote that article is that there have been a number of members of the House and Senate who have publicly complained that their constituents are giving them a hard time. These are constituents who elected them, who are flooding the phones and the faxes and the emails and demanding that these members of Congress stop normalizing the administrative coup, as you properly called it, and say that we need to pull out all the stops to push back. It's about tonality. It's about the way in which these members of Congress do or don't use all the tools at their disposal, and particularly in the Senate, there are ways to block legislation. But we've seen an unwillingness by almost every Democrat in the Senate to do it, because often it requires 3/5 or 2/3 of the Senate for legislation or judges or others to move forward. Sometimes a single senator can stop a move by the administration. But there's this phony politeness and normalization that has to be challenged. And I wrote the piece because it's absurd when members of Congress pretend that they're doing all they can when actually they could be doing much more.
What's the effectiveness of the response by Minority Leader, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer? They've certainly been spotted at press conferences. They've signed press releases. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what they've done so far as the leaders of both the House and Senate in the opposition party, quote unquote, and what more they could be doing.
Well, unfortunately, Hakeem Jeffries as the minority leader in the House and Chuck Schumer as the minority leader in the Senate have both pretty much hewed to the usual line. And I'll give you an example where Hakeem Jeffries, soon after the second Trump inauguration, made a beeline to California and met with some big donors around Silicon Valley. And according to a report in the Politico magazine, he assured them that Democrats were going to move toward the center. And that is a way of saying that the Democrats in Congress will endeavor to move toward the direction that Trump has been moving, Trump moving ever rightward. And it's pretty clear that the prescription that is being promoted by this very powerful Democrat on Capitol Hill is we shouldn't have too much daylight between us and him. The Yale professor Jason Stanley, the professor who has been an expert for many years on fascism, points out that this is a way to normalize and continue to move the goalposts. So the more fascistic that Trump becomes, when you have leadership, quote unquote, like Hakeem Jeffries saying, well, we're going to move to the center so we don't seem that different from Trump, and we're going to stay away from a strong progressive opposition, that's a way of normalizing the fascistic policies and authoritarian government that we're seeing increasingly. So I think part of it is to move in the other direction and say, we're going to put up a fight. It's not only in terms of procedural measures such as demanding roll call votes and doing filibusters as much as possible in the Senate and so forth, which are important measures, and doing walkouts at times and trying to deny quorums. Those are all tactical measures that can be used on Capitol Hill. It's about the tone. It's about the attitude that's transmitted to the base of the party and the people in this country. And I think we need the change in tone to go way up in terms of the not just so much the decibels as the communication of urgency, and also naming what this is. This is a dictatorial takeover of the U.S. government, and we've got to recognize it and fight against it.
Norman, I did want to ask you about primaries. How do you see the threat of primaries being used against these incumbent Democratic legislators who aren't doing much or enough to oppose the Trump regime? How effective do you think that could be?
There are opportunities in many districts across this country, now represented by very feeble, weak, equivocal Democrats, where the voters in that district are to the left of the incumbent. I don't think it's really too soon at all to do a grassroots campaign, the kind that AOC did several years ago in New York City. That requires a lot of groundwork because it involves progressive grassroots organizing a year ahead, more than a year ahead, to really do it. So I would encourage people, not as an impulse item later on, not as just a fun, frivolous thing to do. If we're serious about taking power away from those who want to give it to corporations in this country, it means planning ahead and organizing in communities. Primaries can make a big difference, and I think it's important to prepare for them.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of the activist group RootsAction.org, and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Find a link to his recent article titled, Democrats Irritated by Voters Who Elected Them Need an Attitude Adjustment, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 7th, New Haven, Connecticut, joined San Francisco and Santa Clara County, California, in suing the Trump administration after it issued an executive order on day one that instructed the Department of Justice to pause and possibly rescind billions of dollars in federal funding for cities that have protections in place for undocumented immigrants. The number of jurisdictions that have joined the lawsuit is now up to 21. New Haven is no stranger to taking the lead on immigration issues. In 2007, the coastal New England city became the first jurisdiction in the country to issue a municipal ID card to residents, regardless of immigration status. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with New Haven Mayor Justin Elliker, who issued a welcoming city executive order upon taking office in January 2020. That order expanded an earlier directive to police to all city employees. The order barred city workers from inquiring about any resident's immigration status in their interactions unless required by law. That meant that while employees could not interfere with federal immigration officials, they were also not permitted to assist them in identifying or arresting undocumented immigrants. Here, Mayor Elliker explains that the lawsuit relies mostly on the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which states any powers not explicitly given to the federal government by the Constitution belong to the individual states or to the people.
The lawsuit argues that the executive order violates the 10th Amendment, separation of powers, the spending clause, the due process clause, and the Administration Procedures Act. The foundation of it is around the 10th Amendment, our 10th Amendment protections. The lawsuit asks the court to declare the federal actions unlawful and enjoin the federal government from enforcing the challenge portions. And, you know, specifically the threat of the executive order is to cut funding to municipalities that have some sort of welcoming city or sanctuary city order or ordinance. That's the wrong thing to do, period, but it would dramatically impact our public safety in our city because we rely on particularly a lot of Department of Justice funds to help support initiatives to keep people safe in our community.
The article I read said $6.4 million in Department of Justice grants. There's a lot of other federal funding, too, that comes to the cities, including New Haven. Would they also be at risk or just these funds?
We don't really know. The Trump administration seems hell-bent on going as far as possible to steamroll anyone in their way and cut as much as possible of important services to people across the nation. The executive order was more specific about DOJ funding and Department of Homeless Security funding, but there are other initiatives. I understand there's a House bill that is focused on cutting all funding.
Mayor Justin Elliker, I've seen two responses in the local media coverage of New Haven joining this lawsuit. One point of view is that New Haven should not draw attention to itself in this way, that it will likely make the Trump administration come down even harder or faster on our welcoming city, and that no good can come of it. The other point of view is that Trump is cutting federal jobs and federal funds that go to cities and states in any case, so it's better to fight back. Can you respond to both of those positions?
I thought a lot about whether we should join the lawsuit and raise our head and follow our values and be a part of pushing back, or if we should be more quiet and not draw attention to ourselves. And, you know, after a good amount of thought, I feel quite strongly that that's the wrong approach, that we should all raise our heads, all push back, and all fight for our values and talk about what's wrong right now. I mean, if we are complicit, if we obey in advance, if we try to hide under a rock, we'll be complicit in what's going on at the federal level. And they're coming for us regardless. It's probably a matter of time before they do raids in all of our cities. And if a few of us raise our heads, there's a potential that a couple of us get our heads chopped off. If all of us raise our heads, it's a lot harder to do that. The other thing I'd say is that every city that has some welcoming city or sanctuary city order or ordinance will benefit from this lawsuit in the end. And it did not seem fair to me to allow a handful of municipalities like San Francisco carry our water, that we should be a part of the lawsuit ourselves because we shouldn't be benefiting from something that someone else does a lot of hard work on and takes some of the hits on while we stand on the sidelines. I'd also just add that we are not supportive of the idea of immigrants who are violent people being in our community. And I think that that is something that is over and over repeated by the Trump administration, misrepresented by the Trump administration about a lot of the cities that are either sanctuary cities or welcoming cities, is this idea that we're harboring criminals and evil people. That is factually not correct. That is just a lie. If there are violent criminals in our community, we'll hold them accountable. And in cases where there's a violent criminal in our community, we'll work with ICE to make sure that they're deported. The only thing I'd add is that I think there's a question in everyone's mind right now around the nation of whether the Trump administration is actually going to follow what the courts say, which is deeply, deeply disturbing that the president of the United States would not follow what the courts say. But we're optimistic that we'll prevail in this case.
That was New Haven, Connecticut Mayor Justin Elliker. Learn more about the lawsuit filed by nearly two dozen U.S. cities and counties against the Trump regime's executive order targeting sanctuary cities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since his first term in the White House, Donald Trump has labeled the media and journalists as the enemy of the people, a tactic lifted directly from the authoritarian playbook that advises would-be despots to attack the press and dismiss any criticism as fake news. After his 2024 election win, Trump has escalated his attacks on the press by suing multiple media outlets for reporting he dislikes. That includes the CBS show 60 Minutes, ABC anchor George Stephanopoulos, and the Des Moines Register. The White House has also barred the Associated Press from covering White House events because the AP refused to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, as the president decreed in a January executive order. More recently, the Trump regime has ended nearly a century of practice in which the Independent White House Correspondents Association selected a rotating group of news outlets to cover the president inside the White House and on trips. Now the president himself will select the journalists who get to ask him questions. The association condemned the action, declaring that this move tears at the independence of a free press in the U.S., and announced it would no longer distribute White House poll reports that the public can no longer trust. The Trump administration has openly discussed using the Federal Communications Commission to target the licenses of radio and TV outlets whose reporting they disagree with. Meanwhile, billionaire owners of major media outlets have intervened in newsroom policies to demonstrate their fealty to Donald Trump in order to deter retaliation. Your reporter spoke with Catherine Jacobson, Canada and Caribbean Program Coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists, who takes a critical look at Trump's alarming campaign of threats and intimidation to suppress U.S. press freedom.
The kind of dizzying array of different executive orders and, you know, just comments made by Trump and his associates in the first month plus of the presidency have really been part of the kind of flood the zone technique, right, to make it difficult to keep up with what's going on. And part of that is an attack on the media, really, and making it much more difficult for journalists to do their job. It's about controlling the narrative and making sure that the journalists and the public more broadly are aware of how the White House feels about their reporting, right? And what we've seen from the White House is barring the Associated Press from pool events, which seems especially egregious given the AP's kind of position as one of the largest news agencies in the world, really, with subscribers all across the United States and globally. What that really means, it's a lot more difficult for local news outlets to be able to keep up with the news and also then for the American public to keep up with what's going on. You know, other actions, taking back control from the White House Correspondents Association and deciding who can attend pool events is kind of yet another measure from the White House to try and control who can access what information and when, and really sets a tone for intimidation or trying to intimidate anyway the National Press Corps in a very concerning way.
Catherine, I did want to ask you about, we've seen over recent years, and particularly during the 2024 election, that disinformation, right-wing propaganda networks in particular, have been very successful in changing the narrative and changing many voters' perception of reality, which certainly impacts outcomes of elections. And there's been an effort by some to create independent media that can counter what's been going on in terms of podcasts and social media
that had been so successful in sowing distrust of institutions, as well as spreading lies that a substantial number of Americans believe to be the truth. What are some of your thoughts on effective ways to combat disinformation? I know you've probably given it some thought. What are just a minute or so of some things you've been thinking about?
I think the most important thing, though, is to kind of continue to document factually what is going on. This is, you know, my personal belief that eventually the universe will kind of bend toward justice, right? And that the factual narrative will win out, right? I think it's important to still engage with people who perhaps have different views than us and have kind of a logical discussion about what's actually going on, because there is enough evidence to show that this disinformation is just that, right? That it's not accurate and that the people who are putting it out have ill intent, right? That's why it's called disinformation and not just misinformation. And so I think by having that dialogue, as difficult as it might be, and trying to understand what drives people to want to believe those narratives is very important. And I also just kind of want to add one last thing, if I could. I think there's this idea that we would never have these types of problems in the United States, right? I remember when I first started in this role about, 7 years ago, working on issues of press freedom in the United States, people were kind of like, oh, that's nice. You must not be that busy, right? And now there's very much a demand and understanding that there are press freedom issues here. And in fact, we do have a lot to reckon with in this country. American exceptionalism in understanding the media doesn't really work, right? I think we also need to look at what has happened in other countries, such as, you know, Hungary or Russia, for instance, to see, and not to compare what's going on here to there, but to see patterns of control of the media and control of the narrative and how that has led to democratic backsliding, and to think long and hard about how we can prevent that in this country.
That was Catherine Jacobson, Canada and Caribbean Program Coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Learn more about the Trump regime's attack on press freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on KHOY in Ames, Iowa, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, Global Community Radio nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.